Well, hello everyone. My name is Caleb Mitchell, if we haven't met. I'm connected through the men's Bible study and help facilitate that. And also my family and I serve on the weekly connections team. So good to meet you all. I'm going to read out of John chapter 12 today, starting in verse 20, if you want to read along with me. Now among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip went and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered, "This voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So the crowd answered him, "We have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" So Jesus said to them, "The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light." When Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. This is God's word.
Thanks be to God. Well, we mentioned last week that we are, as we're working through the Gospel of John together, that we're now in the final week of Jesus' life. We started what's called Holy Week with the beginning of it, the Palm Sunday, the Sunday before Easter. We had that passage last week. And it will continue on until Jesus dies. We're seeing the final week of Jesus' life. And we know this because just about every single passage from here on out, we have this little reminder at the beginning of it. The Passover was this many days away. The Passover was coming. It almost works as this ticking clock for us, reminding us, Passover's coming, Passover's coming. And this is not the first time that we've had something like this in the Gospel of John. John, the author, tends to include these markers throughout, letting us know, hey, something's coming. Something is on the horizon. Keep an eye out for it. I don't want you to miss it. Something is coming. Throughout the Gospel of John, we've constantly been told about this hour that Jesus has. Jesus refers to it as his hour. So it's almost like a literal clock in many senses. He keeps saying his hour is coming. John chapter 2, Mary talks to him at this wedding to when something is going wrong, and Jesus says, "My hour has not yet come." John chapter 5, Jesus says, "My hour is coming when the dead will be raised to life." All throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus is saying, "My hour is coming, my hour is coming," but it's not yet here. That is until we get to the all-important verse that was just read for us. John chapter 12 marks a change in that. Look at verse 23 again. And Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." The hour has finally come. All throughout the Gospel of John, we've had this reminder, "My hour is not yet, my hour is coming." But now we have this shift into, "My hour has finally come." That seems significant. But Jesus also includes what this hour means, what it entails, that it will involve him being glorified. Now we have another strand that John has been leaving throughout this gospel, and it's finally getting tied up here. Glory is something that shows up all throughout the Gospel of John. By my rough count, it shows up about 17 times or so before this chapter, and now it's all over the place in chapter 12. It's in verse 23, which we just read, but also it's in verse 28, 29, 41, 43. One of the basic Bible reading tools that we talk about is that when an idea or a theme is being repeated, we should probably make some note of that. That seems like it's going to be significant for our understanding of the passage. All throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus has been talking about his hour, and now he says his hour has come. All through the Gospel of John, Jesus has been talking about glory and being glorified, and now that's showing up all throughout this chapter. When these two repeated ideas collide in chapter 12, that ought to make us something is going to happen in chapter 12. And it's all going to be about glory. Cool. What's glory? Glory feels like it's one of those church words that we talk about, and we could probably fumble through giving an answer. It's the youngest Mitchell. But we're not sure what it fully means. If I asked you, what is glory, do you feel confident in the answer that you can give? And it's confusing as well because there's multiple ideas of it. Glory in the Old Testament, when it speaks of it, it literally speaks of the weight of something, like how much weight something has. And the idea being that when you see the weight, the worthiness of something, it tells you how significant it is. Like imagine you're going between two different products and you don't know which one to buy and you pick up one of them and it's heavy. And you can tell just from that, like this is made really well. It has excellent craftsmanship. This is truly a valuable thing. And then you pick up a similar item and it's really lightweight. It's easy to move. It's more mass-produced, but it just kind of feels like it's going to give way to your hand. Like it will just crumble in your hand. That's the picture of what's being talked about here. When something is glorious, it has this weight, this value to it, this worth, so we can tell that it is significant. Glory is almost always tied to power or authority. That you see these individuals or even God himself who has the ability to make decisions, the power to follow through with it. To decide the matters of this world. But it's not just authority. That's not what glory is talking about. It's the visible display of that power. The visible display of that authority when we see it with our own eyes. Glory in the New Testament is this picture of radiance. Almost like this glow that comes off of something. That when someone doesn't just have a position, but people can actually see it. They can see their power. They can know this person's character because it's put on display. See, it's not enough for someone to have a position or authority and then to hide away in a room somewhere. That's not what glory is. Glory is obvious. It's apparent. It shows the significance, the authority. All of that has been put on display. We could tell the character, their position, their ability, because it's been made visible to us. Let's think about this in a way that we might be able to capture it with our mind. So kings at this time would be seen as having this glory, that because of their position, because of their power, that they were held up as having this significance, this value because of it. And that was reflected in the things that they wore. That was reflected in the room by which they would execute their power. That was reflected in what they ate, what they rode in. All of these trappings around them was this visible way to reflect what was true about them, that they were glorious. And the response was due in turn. All of the pomp and circumstances that people would respond to with this person, being able to see, I see your glory on display, so I am responding to you in the right and proper way. That's what glory would look like. But we see something different with God. Psalm 19 tells us that the heavens declare the glory of God. He's not in a chamber somewhere. He's not with all these drapings around him that makes people go, yeah, he must be a great king. Look at this glory that comes from him. But all of creation shows us that God is glorious. All of creation is revealing the value, the significance, the worth as that's put on display for all to see. Here is this one with authority. Here is this one whose character is radiated out from him. Here is this one whose whole world is full of his glory. And what John has been saying throughout this gospel is that the world will acknowledge Jesus in the same way. The whole world will see that he has this heaviness, this worthwhileness, The whole world will see that he has authority. The whole world will see his character put on display. The whole world will see his nature, which will radiate throughout all of nature. And the world will see that starting now. Verse 23 says, the hour has come, finally, for Jesus to be glorified. And that feels like a natural conclusion to where we are in the story. I mean, we left off with the Palm Sunday passage last week where Jesus enters into Jerusalem with all of these symbols of Jewish ethnicity, Jewish restoration, Jewish identifiers all on display, where this crowd is saying, here comes our Jewish king. We're acknowledging him. He is worthy. He is beautiful. He is powerful. And we are putting that on display with our actions because it's been put on display for us. Here is this one who is glorious. So for Jesus to say, the hour has come for me to be glorified, we're like, yeah, we just saw that. That was the last passage. He's finally been acknowledged. He's finally been worshiped. He's finally been seen as glorious. But what Jesus does in this chapter is actually correct what his glory is. This crowd has finally seen what's true, but Jesus tells them, but you don't see the reason why it's true. Yes, you were right to respond to me in that way. Yes, you were right in seeing my glory, but you do not understand why I'm glorious. You do not understand why I'm worthy, why I have authority, why I'm beautiful. This chapter is of so much significance, not just because it's the culmination of many ideas that have started off from chapter one. In fact, if you read chapter one in comparison to this one, so many of the themes are repeated. So much of the teaching is repeated. It's like a parallel of what we've seen already, and yet there's a correction within it. What's distinction here is what Jesus is doing to show us why he is glorious. In short, why it is that he's come. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. But in doing this correction and bringing this out, well, there's so much paradox that shows up in this chapter. There's so much that doesn't seem logical, that doesn't seem like the right thing. It doesn't make sense to this original crowd, and it certainly doesn't make sense to us either. The picture of glory that he just received, well, it seems like this correction goes so far in the other direction that it's hard for us to understand it. Jesus, in this short chapter showing why he is glorious, does so in a way that it often doesn't make sense. Now, one of the first ways that we see that is immediately following this day where this Jewish audience says, here is our Jewish king, he expands who he is the king of. The day after, this crowd of Jewish people herald him as the one that they're waiting for, the one that all Israel has been waiting for, that he's going to come in and kick out Rome. He's going to get all the foreigners and cast them aside. Well, it's actually a group of foreigners that spawns this whole conversation. These Greeks come up to him. They want to see him, and we're never told if he does or not. But it's in that very act of them coming to him that he says, my hour has now come. See, what Jesus is showing us, that right after this day of so much Jewish celebration of their king arriving, well, he's actually showing that the king of Israel is the king of the whole world. That's not what they were expecting. That's not what they thought he would come to do. That as he's welcoming in these Greeks, it feels confusing because they thought he was going to be kicking out those who oppressed Israel. And in doing so, he actually fulfills an accidental prophecy from right before our passage. John 12, verse 19 says, so the Pharisees said one to another, you see that you gain nothing. Look, the whole world has gone after him. And once you know it, the very next thing that we see is those from the whole world coming to Jesus. This crowd had just been saying, you are glorious for what you will do to Israel. And Jesus is saying, I've actually come to draw all people to myself. That's a paradox. It doesn't line up with the picture of glory that we saw earlier. It doesn't line up with what this crowd has been hoping for. It doesn't seem to capture what they need in this moment. How can Jesus be doing this when it's so contrary to what we've just said he was going to do? But Jesus says, this is the very reason why I've come. To be glorified. The second paradox of Jesus' glory is by far the greatest. He says the hour of glory is him being lifted up. And we might say, yeah, of course. Like to be lifted up, to be glorified is the same thing. This is to be honored, to be exalted. But Jesus, in a paradoxical way, is saying, that's actually not what I mean. And he plays with words a little bit with this. Look at verse 32. Jesus is talking here. He said, "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." And we get a little commentary note here to help us understand what's going on. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. See, what is it that shows the weight, the radiance of Jesus? What is it that shows his character and puts that on display for the whole world to see? What is it that shows his beauty and value and worth? Well, it's that he goes to die. In him being lifted up on a cross, that's what makes him worthy of being lifted up in glory. And that makes absolutely no sense. Why in this heightened moment of fervor? Why when this crowd is finally acknowledging him? Why when people see that he is glory? Why would that be so tied to his death? I mean, it makes no sense. In a time where people will finally see that he is king, he is creator, he is ruler, he is worthy and beautiful, why would that have to come through something that means suffering and shame and ridicule and sorrow? But Jesus, in his great mercy for us, knows when he tells us something that feels paradoxical, that feels like it makes no sense, him being glorified means him dying. It's as if he takes us by the hand and guides us through understanding. He uses this illustration to give direction for it. Verse 24. He said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." His point is that if a seed or if a grain of wheat is just left where it's at, that's all it will ever be. It's just going to be that seed. But it's only when it's planted, when it's buried, so to speak, that's when it becomes something so much more. When it's put into the earth, that's when it becomes something more. When a seed is, quote unquote, dies, that's what allows for life to burst from it. Jesus is showing the necessity of this being his picture of glory because of what it will produce. Which leads into the final paradox of this section, verse 25. "Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." All that Jesus has been saying, that he has come to die, to be lifted up on the cross, that's what brings about his glorification. Well, that's not just for him, but for all who seek to follow him. This is the model of the life they are to live. We'll talk about this more next week, because I think this is what the thrust of our first section of chapter 13 is about. But our final paradox is, whoever hates his life will keep it for eternity. That doesn't make any sense. The one who seeks to keep their life will lose it, but whoever loses it will gain it. All throughout this chapter, we see these paradoxes showing up. He was acknowledged as the king of Israel, and he says, nope, that's too small for everything. But we thought that you were going to do these things for us. We thought you were going to help in this way. I've come for more than that. His picture of glory is him going to the cross. Well, how does that make sense? Even the crowd is confused. I thought the Son of Man was supposed to be around forever. It's like, but that only happens if I go to die. And here, this picture of following him, whoever seeks to keep their life, who loves their life more than anything else, will lose it. But those who love him more than anything else will keep it for eternity. Just paradoxes all throughout this chapter. But I want to go back. I want to draw our attention again to what Jesus is saying, that by him going to the cross, by him being buried, that is the very mechanism that not only brings him glory, but brings us life. That is what Jesus is focusing on in this section. And it's significant, not just because that hour that's been talked about throughout the Gospel of John is finally happening here. It's significant not just because glory, which has been permeating throughout this gospel, is finally showing up here. But it is also that in this chapter, we have the very last public words of Jesus. This is the last time that Jesus addresses a crowd until he goes and is arrested. This is the last time that Jesus speaks to a group of people that's not just his disciples in this really close and personal way in the last week of his life. This is the very last public declaration that Jesus makes. And so when we think about all of what's converging on this chapter, the ideas that are finally being tied up here, the themes that have been started and finally come here, but you add to that, this is the very last thing that Jesus publicly says. It's as if there's exclamation points going off all throughout this, telling us, you need to get this. What do you need to get? Verse 27. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, but for this purpose, I've come to this hour. See, Jesus describes here the very purpose why he has come, the very reason why he's here. And it's everything that we've talked about. All those paradoxes that are throughout this chapter, like how does this work? How is he this king for everyone? When we thought he was coming to do something for us, Jesus says, I've actually come for something even greater than that. How is it that he's going to go to the cross? Because he's producing something even greater than that. How is he setting this life of stewardship? Because he is producing in us something even greater than laying down our lives. See, all of those paradoxes that don't seem to make sense, when Jesus sees the value that comes from what he's come for, when Jesus sees the purpose of what he has come to this earth for, when Jesus sees what is produced by this moment of glory, well, it makes all the sense in the world. See, it's for this reason, for this purpose, that Jesus found it worthwhile to leave the glory that he has always experienced, left eternity of ruling over the entire world. For this purpose, he emptied himself. He took on the form of a servant, took on the form of humanity to join in with humanity. For this very purpose, Jesus is obedient even to the point of the cross. For this very purpose, Jesus' heart is troubled, knowing what's about to happen, yet saying it is worth it. That he is about to be that seed who is buried. He is about to be this weighty, this beautiful, this worthwhile one who lays that all aside to go to the cross. Because it's in his burial, in that seed breaking, in his death that this happens. Life shoots forth from it. Do you know what Jesus says in that illustration? The seed is buried. Unless a seed is buried, it just remains alone. But if it dies, that's when it bears much fruit. What's this fruit he's producing? I mean, it's easy to think about the fact like, yeah, he's going to be buried, but he'll come back to life. It will shoot forth new. But that misses what is happening here. It's when these non-Jewish people are brought before him, that's when he finally says, now's the time. Something about that triggers it from not yet, not yet, not yet, now. So when this crowd is gathered around him that he says he's going to die and not just be raised again, but to gather all people to himself, the result of him being lifted up, the result of his hour of glory, the proof of his glory, the very purpose why he came is because when he dies, when he is buried, you are that life that shoots forth. You are that fruit that is produced from his death. You are the one who's made new. That sure seems to make Jesus glorious. The God of the universe who joined with us, the God of the universe who endured the cross, the God of the universe who endured shame and ridicule, what looked like a moment of absolute destruction, is a moment of glory because of what is produced by it, because of what is accomplished by it, because it shows us what our God is like. I mean, think about the other pictures of glory that we might see. Some king somewhere who has all the trappings of glory, all of the great fabric that he is wrapped in, all of the best mounts to ride, this beautiful palace, everything about it. You look from the outside and it's like, this must be someone. And you compare it to a man who's beaten, who goes to the worst instrument of death mankind has created. I mean, there's no comparison between the two, right? One is so obviously glorious, and the other one, well, it looks so obviously shameful. But remember what we said glory is. It is something that has substance to it. It's weighty, it's valuable. You can pick it up just handling it in your hands and see this has been made well. Those kings and all the right trappings of glory, despite all their pomp, all of their circumstances, it'll just crumble in your hands. It's not going to last. They get what? 10, 20, 30, 40 years of reign? On a cosmic scale, what is that? That's not built for life. It won't last. It won't fall apart. It's too small. It's too insignificant. But when you look at Jesus going to the cross, and that is a place of craftsmanship. That is something that's so weighty because he is accomplishing something no one else could. No king, no person of authority. Jesus alone is accomplishing something that no one else could. And we look at the cross as a place of awe, as a place of glory. We talked about glory as this idea of authority, of power. And other kings will have that, but they're only ruling over a small place. Even the biggest empires are minuscule compared to the whole world. But when Jesus takes his throne, when Jesus goes to the cross, he is being put on display for all he's come for, which is all. We talk about this visible representation of glory, and you can only fit so many people into a chamber. You can only get so many people to be singing songs for their kings. But when Jesus is displayed on the cross, he's revealing to everybody the radiance of his glory. See, when we look at Jesus on the cross, we don't join the mockers and the scoffers, but we look at how Jesus goes and how he, in this act, makes life possible, and that is glorious. It's in him doing what I could not. And it's for that reason he came. He comes to this broken world to put the broken pieces back together by enduring brokenness itself. By him looking at humanity desperate for something, and he comes to reveal all of that, and we still don't get it. This crowd is around him. This booming voice from heaven says, "This is the one who has glorified my name. This is the one who is doing what I've called him to do." And the crowd's like, "What was that? What could that possibly mean?" He's doing all that he could to reveal what he's come for, and people still don't get it. But by him going to the cross in what looks like a moment of shame, he's taken us by the hand to reveal all that he's doing for us. I'm going to help you see it. I'm going to guide you. You have too small of a picture of why I am glorious, but I will magnify that for you. And it takes a cross to see that. I mean, those who are here this morning, walk in the light. Do not walk in the darkness, as Jesus talks about here. Do not be like those who believe in Jesus for a moment, like trust in him, but they don't want to confess of that because that will come at a cost. Nothing else is this deserved. Nothing else will be as valuable. Nothing else can give you hope. It is only by Jesus, only by him going to the cross and what looks like a moment of shame. By him going to the tomb, which looks like a time of defeat, the end of a movement. Remember that Jesus guy? Well, he died like all the rest. Now, by him doing that, life burst forth, given for you as life and life eternal. And just like that, when he wraps up this sentence, this statement, thus concludes the final moments of Jesus' public ministry. Following this, he'll spend this time with his disciples and get this really close, intimate time, give guidance and instruction of what life will look like after he is gone, after he's died and buried. Even having this meal with his disciples, explaining what it is that he's about to do. And following that meal, he's arrested. Following that meal, he's on trial. Following that meal, he goes to the cross. Following that, he brings life for all.